I guess my first question is, and for any doctor, my question would always be, what drove your decision to get into medicine?
So that goes back to about the eighth grade. And, you know, up until the eighth grade, I had kind of decided I either wanted to be a truck driver or a farmer or a preacher, believe it or not. And so in the eighth grade, our whole class was required to spend a good part of a day taking what they called a Cooter aptitude test to find out what kind of things we would naturally be good in. And also in the seventh and eighth grade, I'd been learning about the scientific method in science, and that excited me, the way that things are thought out to be a certain way and the way you prove them and then it becomes a fact. I took this Cooter aptitude test with the rest of my class, and then 6 months, 4 months, 5 months later, we get the results. And so my top score was in something that was unheard of to me. It was called social science. And, you know, to an eighth grader, what does social science mean? I've learned all about science and about math, things like that, but I had no idea what social science was. So as I kind of pursued this over the next 6 months or a year, people kept telling me, well, you know, you're a people person. Well, what does that mean? You know, but in the meantime, my second high level was in math, and the third one was science, physical science and things like that. You know, having learned about the scientific method that year, I decided, kind of talking with my folks, I need to look at that and think, you know, scientifically, I'm not going to be a good truck driver. I'm not going to be a good farmer. For one thing, I didn't not have any farm to inherit, but I love working in hay fields and stuff like that. And I'm probably not going to be a good preacher. So that's kind of how I came around to narrowing it down to being a family doctor. And I really wanted to be a family doctor. Mm-hmm. And I had this little town of Cheney, Washington, that I grew up in. We had three other family doctors. And Cheney at that time had about 2,000 people, maybe 2,500 people.
So let's fast forward a little bit. So we go to school in Washington, and then graduation comes about and we're finished with school. And how did we make the decision? We made the decision to become a doctor. Now, how do we make the decision to move all the way up to, at the time, very rural Alaska?
So as I went to medical school, I got to my last summer off between my third and fourth years of medical school. And I knew if there's anything that I ever wanted to do in life, I needed to do it that summer. I had the freedom. I was not married. I was not tied down. And one of the things I really wanted to do was go to Alaska and try it out. And by try it out, I mean, I thought I could hop on my motor scooter and in a day or two be in Alaska. But that wasn't the case, I learned. Okay.
Takes a bit more time than that.
It's not just a few hundred miles up over the Canadian border. And so I was able to get a summer job working in Juneau, Alaska, as a what we called an extern, meaning you're a medical student ready to graduate, but you've not graduated as an actual official MD doctor yet. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I spent the summer 3 months working there and living in the hospital. The Sisters of St. Anne ran the little hospital. And since I lived in the hospital, anytime emergencies would come in, I would be the first person to get to see the emergency because they had no ER doctors like we do today in bigger hospitals. The doctor, whatever doctor might have been on call, would have had to come in, and it takes 20 minutes or so for the doctor to get there. But usually I could be right there in a matter of a minute or two, you know. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And it was such an exciting summer. I loved what I was learning and getting to work with other physicians of different specialties, the surgeons and the internist, the pediatrician. I got to learn a lot.
Yeah.
And it just excited me. I knew more than ever I wanted to be a family doctor. And I went back that fall to start my fourth year medical school. And I still wanted to be a general practitioner then, because family medicine did not become a specialty until 1969. And this is back in 1962 and 63, mm-hmm. before I graduated. But during my last year of medical school, I got called into the dean's office on two different occasions, and the dean did his best to subtly try to convince me that I ought to either go into some type of academic medicine, or I ought to get into research, because at that time the University of Washington School of Medicine was growing as research departments of all sorts, or some type of specialty that would be beneficial if I got drafted into the military. And at that time, the Vietnam War was just coming up, so I knew I was going to probably be drafted. But he didn't really sway me. The dean and his assistant dean did not really sway me, because I knew as a childhood, you know, my childhood growing up in this town with the three different family doctors, our GPs, and I mowed their lawns for a couple of summers, and I'd have a chance to talk to them and see them in the morning and at night and things like that. I knew I wanted to be a GP in a little town.
And so you spent some time in Juneau, and so that introduced you to Alaska. How did you find Kenai and come to establish a practice here?
I graduated at the end of my fourth year of medical school. And meantime, I had met my wife, and that's another story, maybe for another time, because I knew that I had to go to Alaska after that summer, 3 months. I knew I needed to go back to live someday and try it out for longer. And Carol Lee, bless her heart, she agreed, well, if that's what it takes to get married, I'm willing to do that. I'll go with you. We'll try it out for 3 years. And I agreed, if we started a family, that she and the kids could go back to the Northwest as long as they wanted to in the summer. And so that's kind of how we got married 3 days after I graduated. And she was a new nurse, by the way. That my fourth year of medical school was her first year of actually working as a nurse. Yeah.
And that's something that I wanted to make sure we mentioned, too, is your wife, Carol Lee, has been a major part of the practice all these years.
She has. She has been. And a tremendously wonderful backup. When I had somebody that I needed to come and help me with my office, with the delivery of a baby, or a person comes in with their toe cut off, or their part of their wrist cut off, or their hand. You know, we did not have any hospital when I first moved to Kenai, and we'll probably talk about that down the road a little bit. But anyway, she agreed to come to Alaska. But following medical school, I had an internship, which is like a first year of residency. Mm-hmm. And that was in Minnesota. Uh-huh.
So got used to the cold there.
Oh, yes. Oh, my. And the wind.
And the wind.
Uh-huh. Those cold Midwestern winters, they'll get you.
That's very true. Yeah. Very true.
Thinking back to, you opened your practice in 1967? Yeah?
In Kenai,
okay. So what came before that then?
Actually, during my internship in St. Paul, Minnesota, I was at the county hospital. It was known then as Anchor Hospital. It was an old hospital that was built around 1900. And I started my internship making $50 a month, and my wife got a job at another private hospital making $300 a month as a registered nurse. So that's how we really got started. And, you know, by the time my year as an intern was up, I was making $75 a month coming up.
Got the roles reversed there for the breadwinner. That's great.
Yeah. So with the money that she was making, we saved it up, and we bought a little travel trailer and loaded everything that we owned into it, and started the trek west and started the trek towards Alaska. I knew that I could have a job in Juneau because of the different physicians I had worked with and working in the hospital. There were several open doors there. However, Governor Egan came on the radio one night, and well, we were in Minnesota, and was talking about Alaska and different parts of Alaska, and he was talking about the Kenai Peninsula and the fine weather that they have. And so then I started doing some research. And as we looked into this, Spokane area where I had grown up averages around 16 inches of rain a year. And the city of Kenai that had statistics from the airport averaged around 16 to 17 inches a year. And we just thought, you know, that would be an ideal place that we ought to be looking at. So the whole winter we were in St. Paul, Minnesota, we were kind of focusing on, we're going to get this little travel trailer and we're going to move up and go west and we'll see our families and tell them goodbye and we'll start up the dirty road, the dusty road up to Alaska and see where we go.
Yeah.
That in itself, I feel like, at least from my limited experience, is very much a shared experience with so many people up here. You can always ask that question of, how'd you get up here? And yeah. And everybody's got that story. It's so great. Yeah.
Very true. And the first 25 years that I practiced in Kenai, if someone had lived in the Kenai area for 3 years, we call them an old timer. Yeah, if they passed 3 years, they were an old timer because chances are they were going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
maybe you could talk a little bit about what things, especially from a medical standpoint and that sort of thing. What things were like then, as you mentioned earlier, the hospital in Soldotna had yet to be built. And what I would imagine is that as you slowly establish a practice and get things off the ground, there's a lot of emergency care probably to begin with. And does it maybe take a while to establish that family practice that had been the goal all along?
Yes, it does. I should probably touch on something else that came in the middle of all this.
Sure.
So it was on Good Friday in March of 27th of 1964 that Carolee and I were sitting in the back of a little Volkswagen Bug. Her cousin was driving this Bug from St. Paul, Minneapolis, down to Iowa to spend Easter with relatives, and this radio announcer stopped the music and told about this earthquake going on in Alaska. Well, we had no idea how bad it was until the next day or two, and in some ways, I think her mother was delighted because she knew we're not going to be moving to Alaska after that, because Anchorage, the storefront on different stores had fallen off into the street, and there were crevasses that had opened up, and houses went into the ocean and
make
all these.
Make you think twice.
Yeah, yeah, but that didn't really deter Pete Hansen, because I had enough faith in science to know that's not going to happen again tomorrow or probably in my lifetime, like that. So our first experience of coming to Alaska and coming down on the peninsula, the crevasses in the roads from Anchorage to the Kenai Peninsula were still there. And I've got pictures of Carolee sitting on the hood of my car. We could only go about 10 miles an hour on this road around Turnagain Arm because there were 29 little wooden bridges that had been built. And the road went in and out of every little valley over every little creek. And so there was not the causeway that there is today to drive on. Yeah. So that was a really experience. And we came to Kenai. We camped here for about a week thinking, you know, this could be home, but you know what? There were not enough people to support another doctor. Yeah. The doctor was just moving to Soldotna then,
okay.
Dr. Isaac. And there's just, Soldotna had about 180, 190 people. It was kind of a crossroads. So that's why we didn't stay here. I knew that there was security with a job in Juneau. There weren't enough people here to provide another doctor. Sure. So after we traveled all around the roads that you could drive on in Alaska, we migrated back down to Haines. Took the little Chilkat ferry, which is the only ferry that Alaska had then, only ran from Haines to Juneau, went to Juneau, and that's how we settled.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing was, you know, I mentioned a little while ago, Governor Egan. So the summer, just to backtrack a second, the summer that we moved up to, that I went up to Juneau to work in the hospital, it was a rainy day that I arrived, and I drove up under this canopy of this house, this white old white house, and asked the directions to the hospital where I was supposed to go to work. And I did not know the governor was the governor, but he came out and he talked with me and wanted to know what I was going to be doing all summer and where I was going, where I was from. And then he took the way to the hospital, and it wasn't until a couple of weeks later that he got a fish hook in his arm, caught. He came into the hospital. I was the first guy to see him. And then I discovered he was the governor. Governor Egan, yeah.
How about that for a welcome to Alaska?
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, getting back to Kenai, there weren't enough people here. And so we migrated back down the road to Juneau, and I got a job working mm-hmm. with the clinic group there. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you in Juneau then?
We were there for 3 years.
Okay.
In 3 years, we had three kids. How's that? Okay, and it's not as easy to move with three kids. We had, we drove up the highway from Minnesota. We had one little boy, a month and a half, a couple months old, mm-hmm. a cardboard box in the back seat, mm-hmm. and whoever heard of seat belts. But that's the way we got up here.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
Had there been, well, I guess, so now we're talking 1966?
67.
67.
And
okay.
During those 3 years, I would get because we'd camped here for a while, we got to know the druggist, the own little drugstore, John Huyen was his name, and he would call us up. Meantime, the Standard Oil Company was building a refinery, and their superintendent would call me up in Juneau. Every 6 months or 8 months, I'd get a phone call, and someone would say, well, you know, we sure need a doctor up here. We've got these accidents that are occurring. We've got offshore jack-up rigs coming in, and people that are drilling and getting injured fingers and hands. And mm-hmm. meantime, the clinic that I was with, it kind of folded up, and there was a right opportunity for taking a break, coming up and looking it over one weekend in 1967 in the summer, and after seeing, my goodness, Kenai was about half tar paper shacks and half camper trailers. We called the tar paper shacks TPSs. You know, that was a common term back then.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Because people would get a TPS up, get it framed up, tar paper around it over the roof, and insulate it on the inside. And then they could have a pad, and they could be working 10 hours a day,
yep.
7 days a week, and that's what it was like, just a working machine, this whole town was.
Yeah,
and that's something else that was going on at this time, too, is the Swanson River field and more activity out in the inlet, is more people coming to the area, and all of a sudden, Kenai, that had just a few hundred people in it a couple of years beforehand, is now really growing up fast.
Really growing, yeah.
And so so now that we're in Kenai, did the practice really take off quickly? And I guess tell me, where was your first office?
My first work here was working, by then Saldana had two doctors, Dr. Isaac and Dr. Gady.
Mm-hmm.
And when 1967, when moving my family here to Kenai, these were the only three doctors on the whole peninsula. Seward did not have a doctor. Homer did not have a doctor. There were no other physicians. There was no physician's assistant program. There were no nurse practitioners programs then. And so there was a real need for medical care. And so the doctors in Saldana offered to hire me to go to work for them. And they wanted me to work over in Kenai. And they rented this little chiropractic office. It's on Redoubt Street in Kenai. It's still there, the chiropractor's there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my doctor's office, and they hired one person for me, which is a nurse, local nurse, Gloria Crandall. She came to work, and she had three kids. Actually, Corby and Clyde are still here living in the area, and I've gotten to know them again. But they were little kids then. But there were only two phone lines then from Kenai to Soldatna. And this little clinic, I was getting these injuries coming in from the platforms. Guys were welding foreign bodies in their eyes and just cuts and bruises and fractures. And
it was dangerous work.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was, because working as a roustabout and roughnecks on oil platforms, it is dangerous work. Absolutely. For example, I needed to send someone over to Soldatna, because those two doctors in Soldatna had a little x-ray machine. I didn't have one in my office here that they provided for me. To get through on a phone line, my nurse would give someone in my little lobby, that, because it was a walk-in clinic 24 hours, I mean, it's just all the time going on, all day long, every day. She'd pass the phone out, and people in my little lobby would take turns dialing, because we didn't have push-button phones. And it took somebody dialing for maybe 10 minutes or 15 minutes before they could get through a line to say, we've got to send somebody over there for x-rays. But that's how primitive our phone system was. And Kenai did not have, the city of Kenai had its own power supply. And frequently our power would be out. We were not a part of the HEA system at that time.
Oh, is that right?
And so these are some of the problems that I had with trying to practice medicine in Kenai.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so was that a little bit of culture shock to go from, modern facilities in Minnesota to what I assume were probably decent, if not fully modern, facilities in Juneau, to, wow, we're really building from the ground up here on the peninsula at this time?
It was. It was a big culture shock for my family and my wife, too, because people would get hurt at night if there was a shooting or somebody, an auto accident or motorbike accidents. They would come to the door of our little log house, which was on Linwood Lane here in Kenai. We had a little four-room log house, and it was a culture shock, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look back on life, and I think, feeling that probably what provided the essence of my ability to utilize ingenuity to solve problems and fix things was my having become an Eagle Scout, Eagle Boy Scout back, because as an Eagle Scout, you're prepared as a person can be for any kind of accident or situation that can be traumatic. You're prepared in some way of how to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
You've been through enough of those exercises in scouting for 4, 5, or 6, 7, 8 years that you're prepared for life pretty much. And that really helped me do many things that otherwise I wouldn't have been able to do. Just like being able to make instruments. So I needed this kind of an instrument or that kind of instrument. I could figure out how to get home, get my little welder out and fix this or fix that or make it better. And side cutters and screwdrivers and these things, it's amazing what you can do in the field of medicine with some of these things when you have to.
I'm trying to remember that saying that necessity is the mother of invention. And
yeah, that's right.
Uh-huh.
That does make you get out and think. Yeah.
Use your
brain how to fix this, how to fix that.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
And so that's kind of what I imagined, is that in the days before a big hospital being here now, that there was a lot of that midnight care and emergency stuff. And then, so when the hospital was built in Soldatna, how did that change the practice, or did it really change the practice?
That did not change the nature of my practice very much for several years. And I say that because people in Kenai and the Kiski area were so accustomed to coming to my office. And my office kept growing during that time with more nursing staff, with One of the lifesavers for me was participating, because I love to teach. And I had spent a summer as a student in Juneau way back. So as I got into practice here, I had established relationships with several different university medical schools systems, in Minnesota especially, and UW in Seattle. I began right away after I started practicing here, having a medical student with me much of the time. And back, Carolee and I, we purchased a little parcel of property. It had a little house and a mobile home on it, just for students, mm-hmm. because over my first 35 or 40 years, I've had more than 120-some medical students for 2 months each, mm-hmm. or more. Sometimes they would come, and if they spent more than 2 months, we would pay them a stipend. But these universities, in the meantime, I should back up and say, in 1969, general practice became a specialty.
Yeah.
If a physician wanted to go on and take the additional years of training, then you pass your test, 2-day, 8-hour written exam, and then you get your specialty rating as a board-certified family doctor, which I did in 1970 or so when it first came available. But that allowed me to be part of a teaching process, so other medical schools that had family practice departments that were beginning to form, they would send their students up, their fourth-year medical students, and just for the experience of being in a rural practice without any hospital, mm-hmm. right at your fingertips, because there was so much they could learn. But at the same time, that helped me keep up with the practice of medicine. We call those major medical schools ivory towers in the field of medicine. But you know, what I would learn from these students that would come from the ivory tower, they'd spend a couple months with me, and they would keep me up in tune with all the new modern things that are happening in medicine. Uh-huh. We often use this old adage, see one, do one, teach one. But, you know, when a student has had an opportunity to see how you do certain things, and then you observe them under a different situation, maybe utilizing what they've seen with your expertise right at hand, and then they're off to where they can take out fish hooks and things like that, mm-hmm. knowing exactly how to do it.
And that satisfies, you mentioned earlier, kind of wanting to teach and that sort of thing, that satisfied that part of you as well. So yeah, that's, it all works out.
And we'd always find time to go fishing in the summer, or snowmobiling in the winter, mm-hmm. A little cross-country skiing, things that they like to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, I was a lot younger then. I'll tell you what, there's nothing like being up for 16, 18 hours a day, and you know, you finally go to bed, and 2 hours later, mother calls, and she's in labor, and you've got to deliver a baby, and that takes another 3 hours. Next day, you're supposed to go back to work, right?
I don't know if you have the number off the top of your head, but I'm always curious of a question like this is, how many folks have you helped bring into the world?
How many what?
How many folks have you helped bring into the world? How many deliveries are
close to 1,000, right around 1,000. Wow. I've had a little over 200 in my office before, mm-hmm. before I moved into the hospital on a regular basis. It's amazing. Mothers that had given birth to a baby and mothers and fathers, and as a couple, I like to look at the couple, because most fathers participated in the birth of a child when I would do this in the office. It was just routine. The fathers would come in and because I just like to always educate the fathers a little bit ahead of time, have them come in a couple times with their wife when they would come in for their prenatal exams and mm-hmm. things like that. And oftentimes the fathers would be helpful. If my nurse couldn't get in the middle of the night, it was in the middle of winter, you know, the father could put on a pair of plastic gloves and get this instrument for me out of the cupboard, or this suture material, or whatever I needed.
Uh-huh. Everybody pitches in.
Yeah, yes.
That's so interesting, because I haven't, I don't have any children myself, but That probably feels like such a far removed time for people now, but it really wasn't that long ago.
No, although it was about 50 years ago, you know. And the thing is, after the hospital opened, the families that I had delivered their child in the office, most of them did not want to have the next child or two in the hospital. They wanted to have it in the office because they felt such a close, just a close environment of working together. And if it was during the daytime that a baby was given birth to, I would have a lobby full of patients. But maybe it'd only take me a half hour or 45 minutes to go into the living room and deliver this baby, and I could be right back at work. And that was a big contrast from having to go to the hospital and spend a half a day or more to get back, and all these patients waiting. Mm-hmm. But if patients were in the lobby of my little office, and I had a mother in labor, as soon as that baby would cry, would come out and cry, everybody would... and clap, uh-huh, and shout, and they were so happy to hear this little baby cry.
That's because great.
You know, here's 10 people maybe, or 8 people or more in the lobby waiting, mm-hmm, waiting for the doctor, but
and it was worth here's it. One more into the Kenai family.
Yeah.
and now some of these babies that took their first breaths in your office are grown and have kids and maybe even grandkids of their own at this point, and you've probably treated them too.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That has to make you stop and think for a second, does it, sometimes?
It is. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Yep. One of the difficult things for me in attempting to retire.
Attempting.
Practicing medicine. I say that because my heart is there. And But it took me, I can remember back at the age of 50, thinking, well, by 55, I'm going to retire. Well, then 55 came, it was going to be 60, and then it was going to be 65, and so on. Well, finally, I turned 80 a couple months ago, and I just said, you know, this, I've got to get some other things done that I'm going to do, working on a book and some other things for the community. But what has been difficult for me is that I finally realized 6 months ago is that my patients have become my closest friends. And because of confidentiality in medicine, a family doctor does not make a lot of really close friends because each of your patients that you have gotten to know over the many years, you share stories about life. But those are inside the doctor's office, usually. And those things you don't talk about outside the office. So when you see your patients other places, you don't talk about those things that you do in the office. But anyway, that's what has taken me so long to begin to retire, is that as I've so-called taken this extended leave of absence now from practicing, in other words, retirement, it's knowing I'm not going to get to see most of these people again because our area has grown so much. You know, with 30, 40,000 people in the Kenai-Saldana area, I go to Walmart or Freddy's or Safeway, I may never see a person that I know at all.
Yeah, and did you ever think that would ever be the case when you first moved here and you probably knew just about everybody in town?
Yes, I didn't think that would ever happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think that would ever happen.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it was interesting, you know, pulling up and talking about how many more houses there are in the neighborhood here where you're at and just the growth. I mean, my goodness, the Kenai, your career seems to be right in line with the growth of this area, and that I'll call myself a chachaco. I've only been here about 6 years myself. That to me is one of the things that's really unique about this place is that folks remember before it was a modern, bustling, booming city, And are there things that you miss from that time that you wish were still kind of the same thing, or is it just, you know, progress is progress and that's just how it goes?
So I'm just thinking about your question here, Shailen, and I've never been one to look back. I've got a positive attitude, and I've got an idea what I'm going to do next week and next month and next year. These are all things that I look forward to doing, and I don't really look back. You know, I've had to realize, and as I've taught my students over the years, change, the rate of change changes itself. The rate of change is not constant, but the rate of change is rapidly changing, and where it changes to, I mean, we have to, as humans, if we're going to survive, we have to adapt to this changing process. So the better we can adapt our minds to utilizing new technology and new means of doing things, accomplishing things, and socializing, and we need to adapt. And I try to teach especially my aging patients this. The sooner they get on to using email, the sooner they get on to using some of this digital world, the better they're going to be. They're going to enjoy their later years more if they can do that.
Staying active and looking forward all the time can be a challenge for people sometimes. And so I know for myself that can be a challenge sometimes, but that's something that that's been a big part of how you operate. I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb and guess that some of that has to do with, and I apologize in advance if this is a sensitive subject, but I know that one of the sort of legacies of the Hanson name in Kenai is parks named after your sons who passed away, and some of that attitude about looking forward, does that come from the pain of that loss early on?
We've had our pains, Caroline and I've and our family. You know, we had three children, Eric, Leif, and Bengit, and they were a year apart, roughly. And this is good in many ways because they were able to do things together as they've grown up over the years. And Eric and Leif, the two boys, each became an Eagle Scout. I've been very active in scouting. What really got me back into scouting occurred about 5 years after we were living in Kenai, and that was, I realized suddenly, if I did not do something to discipline myself one night a week, that my kids were going to grow up and I was never going to know them because I was gone so much on weekends and nights working at my office, taking care of emergencies and deliveries and being the only doctor in town mm-hmm. for many, many years.
Huge responsibility.
Yes, and every time the siren, I'd hear a siren, I'd be getting my clothes on at night because I knew I'm going to get called. Mm-hmm. We didn't have pagers for about 10, 15 years, my first 10, 15 years, but the phone would ring, and I always tried to get my clothes on the night before the phone would ring because I knew it was going to ring. I mean,
be prepared.
That's how about it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but anyway, yes, the kids, we've lost both of our boys, and Leif in 1986 on the 4th of July had a kind of a freak accident, drowning accident in Seward, and unexpected, and he was 21 years old. he had his 21st birthday just a few years before that, and that kind of set our whole family back. But the town, the town fathers, city council people, came to our house a week or two or three later and said, you know, we've got all this whole area where the Leif Hanson Memorial Park is now. We'd like to, it was all covered with trees no grass, I mean, just tundra. Mm-hmm. And since our son Leif was, they never found his body. He slipped and fell as he was in the bottom of this little creek just outside of Seward. But little did he know that there was algae on the rocks, and when he stumbled and went through this tunnel about a quarter of a mile long, I mean, he stumbled, fell, must have knocked him out. He went through this tunnel and out over the waterfalls on the other side of Seward and into the ocean, and they never found his body. And so the city fathers came to us a few weeks later and said, you know, we got this concept of a memorial park where people can plant a tree or a bush or flowers in memory of someone that's passed on. And what would you think about our getting the city together to develop that area by Dan's TV down here into a memorial park with sidewalks where there could be a little cutout for a little memento telling about that particular person, and with living memory of that person, such as a tree. And we were just overwhelmed. And you know, why did the city do that? And it all led back to a couple of years before that, for Leafs, you know, to become an Eagle Scout, you've got your 21 merit badges you have to acquire. And then one also has to do something to demonstrate leadership in the community, provide some service. And Leif had come up with this idea when he was about 17, working on his last Eagle, part of his Eagle rank. It was April, and you know, the snow was going like it is right now, mm-hmm. just about gone, and there's all this mess around, plastic bags and paper and old tires and mufflers and stuff by the side of the road. He got this idea of getting together some groups around Kenai, just the city of Kenai. Now, and he got together a half a dozen groups, and they did he laid out this program for area-wide cleanup in Kenai. Well, it was so successful that the next year Soldatna jumped on the bandwagon, and they did it. They started doing it too, and then it grew across the whole peninsula, and now it seemed like it's a major part of South Central Alaska.
Uh-huh, the big spring cleanup, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that was probably a big factor in there was such an outpouring of love and caring for our kids and for Lise. It was just overwhelming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It makes you happy to be in a place when you can have that kind of support.
It does, Shailen. Uh-huh. And then just briefly, maybe I'll tell about our other son.
If you'd like, yeah.
Eric. Eric passed away when he was 32. He had developed a brain tumor a year before that, and that was another one of those tough times. And that's at that time, Caroline and I, we wanted to do something for the community in kind of memory of Eric, and that's how we put together the funds from our family to purchase a little piece of land where the Scout Park is down overlooking the bluff now in Kenai. Yeah, that's how that little park, we purchased that and gave it to the city for the purpose of it being a quiet park for people to come and be able to contemplate and look at the views and take in the scenery and enjoy the weather and all that there is to see from that little spot.
Hardly a prettier spot to watch sunset.
Hardly a prettier spot.
Thank you.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for sharing that a little bit, and it makes me want to talk a little bit more about some of the contributions that that you've made. I mean, a lot of folks know that the Kenai River Marathon started sort of under your watch, and and are there other accomplishments or things that you've contributed over the years that that you consider noteworthy that you're proud of?
There have been several. Yes, the marathon came about. All my life, I have been interested in people. It goes back to that Cooter aptitude test I was telling you about, social science. And I love to see people having a good time in a healthy way. This has kept me involved with community activities and also, well, just to give you an example, I became the first family doctor from Alaska to achieve a national appointment to the American Academy of Family Physicians. And this came about because of my interest in family medicine and in teaching students and residents. And I kind of worked my way up to becoming national president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. But that was like 40 years ago, 35 years ago. But that organization has about 115,000 family doctors in our country today. And so that helped me get involved with education for Alaskan physicians. And in 1986, I was able to put together the first statewide family medicine program for a full week of educational activities for family doctors in Alaska. Because up until then, if a family doctor in Alaska wanted to keep up his medical certification as a physician, family doctor specialist, he had to go outside the lower 48 somewhere. Mm-hmm. He had to go to school, and he had to go to school for a couple of weeks a year. But I was able to put together and get that started. And this last year, we had our 33rd or 34th annual scientific meeting for family doctors in the state.
Great.
And but I was very involved in that for about 10 years, seeing it grow and grow, and a couple of the best attended meetings were always in Kenai. but medicine, learning excites me.
Yeah.
And teaching excites me.
And those are things that we get to do our entire lives.
Yep. Pretty hard to quit.
Well, I'd like to kind of wind down a little bit, but I wanted to ask, you mentioned earlier that you're planning on writing a book, but I know that you keep referring to it as this sort of transition away from work, that not like a full-on retirement. So what are your plans? How are we going to spend all this newfound free time?
So
the list is long, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Peninsula Community Health Services, mm-hmm. that I've been working for the last year and a half, have graciously given me the opportunity to come back and work as long as I keep up my certification, any time I'd like to. And so one of the things that I'm doing right now, at least for a few months, while I'm kind of testing this so-called retirement, whatever you might call it, is I'm working a day or two a month, primarily doing flight physical exams for pilots, airline pilots. And in my practice, I've had more than 350 some different pilots in the course of every 2 years that I have to have examined. We used to have a number of family doctors that did that, a number of physicians, but they have dwindled to there's only one that's left in the area. So, and on the peninsula here, we have a lot of commercial aviation.
Yeah, yeah.
And these people that are in commercial aviation, the commercial people have to have an exam every 6 months to every 12 months, depending on what level of planes they fly and mm-hmm. this kind of a thing. And I love aerospace. I've often told my patients, I wish I could live long enough to get into space. And I've been involved with the Challenger Learning Center here for a number of years on their board of directors. So I'm still doing that at least a day or two a month for a while and to keep these people so they don't have to go to Anchorage or Homer or somewhere else mm-hmm. for their exams.
Yeah, and what a great opportunity to sort of, to use the word, to keep doctoring.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's fun. You see, doctoring does not work for me because I love what I do, but I have pilots that fly in from down on the Aleutian Chain, for example, and from out western Alaska. They can fly into the Kenai Airport. They can walk 3/4 mile over to my office, get their exam, get a taxi ride back, or walk back, get in their plane, fly back home the same day. But those people have to go to Anchorage. They're going to spend a day and a night usually trying to do what they have to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this way it's just like that.
Yeah. And I get input from people that come from Port Ellsworth over in Lake Iliamna and places like that, and these different guides that come in from out in the bush, and they've all got good stories to tell.
I can't even begin to imagine some of those bush tales that come in.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I love it.
I want to ask, what's the best story from some of those bush pilots?
What's the best story?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
And it was this big.
There are there's more stories that I can really...
It's that doctor-patient privilege, maybe a little bit.
It is. And, you know, it's one of those things, when I get outside the office, I don't focus on what happens in the office. Mm-hmm. And so you asked me, you know, what's your favorite? And I can't think of one right now right offhand. It'd take me a minute or two to come up with one.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about this work on a book. What made you decide to go into that endeavor? Because that's a lot of work, too.
On
a book.
On a book?
Yeah.
Well, I've been keying away stories for a long time. Yes, for a book about, yep.
Just life, career?
As I look at life, I'm focusing on the last frontier doctor. Because today in North America, whether you're in Canada or the U.S., there isn't anywhere that I know of that a person, a physician, could go and without any communication with the outside world and do what I've had to do here. Thinking about, you know, there's so many other stories, Shailen, that... various evacuations, air evacuations. Oh my goodness, we averaged one year. We averaged more than one a week, from Kenai to Anchorage, and we had a regular protocol set up. And another whole aspect of my life is training. When I came to Kenai, there was no EMS, no emergency medical services. No EMTs, no paramedics. Program was not even heard of, but training people to help you do what you needed to do to take care of people and becoming a part of the first EMS program in 1975, and helping the Kiske to get their program started and off the ground in 1976 or 77, and then working with both communities for about 25 to 30 years just with the EMS programs, and spending at least a day a month with each one of them, you know, teaching it was exciting.
Yeah,
again, I love to teach, and it's fun to learn too.